ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Thursday, the 21st of March. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, strengthening ties. The UK and Australia sign a new defence agreement as British ministers arrive to discuss the war in Ukraine and Australia's acquisition of nuclear-powered submarines. And the royal crisis drags on. Police are now investigating claims hospital staff tried to access Princess Kate's medical records.
The idea that records would be looked at and then presumably details leaked or sold to the media is actually quite shocking. It's an incredibly awful breach of the Princess of Wales's privacy.
But first to the economy, and there's better than expected news in this month's jobs figures. As many as 116,000 Australians moved back into work in February. The rebound in employment means, according to official data, the seasonally adjusted unemployment rate has fallen from 4.1% to 3.7%. Economists say while the data around this time of year jumps around a bit, it's clear the labour market remains strong. For more, I'm joined by our business reporter, David Taylor. David, is there unexpected strength re-emerging in the jobs market?
No, I think there is, Rachel, and there is no doubt this is a relatively strong jobs report. We had full-time employment rising by 78,200, part-time employment rising by 38,300. So that brings the overall number of people employed to basically well over 100,000 people. That's finding work in February. Now, the underemployment rate decreased to 6.6%, so there are fewer people wanting more hours and more work, and the participation rate rose to 66.7%, so there are actually more people who are confident that they will get a job if they go looking for one, Rach.
So we know that the Reserve Bank is watching this unemployment rate closely in terms of its next interest rate decision. How will this data today influence that thinking on interest rates?
Probably not too much, but the Reserve Bank has gone out of its way recently to say that interest rates could go up, down, or sideways. So this doesn't really indicate that the labour market is particularly weak, which doesn't really warrant a leaning towards cutting interest rates. Most likely, the Reserve Bank will take this in its stride. There is strength and employment continues to grow. Also, Rachel, many people who were out of work in December and January, the ABS says, did actually have jobs lined up. So they'll be not surprised to see this particular job set because they already knew they were going to get work. Economists also say this is not unusual for this time of year. Here's RBC Capital Markets Chief Economist Sue Linong.
A really big increase in headline employment, above 116,000 in the month, upward revisions to the previous month, and coupled with a very big drop in unemployed persons, that's pulled the unemployment rate down lower than we'd anticipated, and that's dropping out at 3.7% for the month of February.
It's the opposite of what the Reserve Bank has indicated that it's worried about. The Reserve Bank's worried about rising unemployment and that potentially pushing interest rate cuts forward. How does this change that landscape?
I guess we'd caution that, we know there's quite a lot of volatility in this particular data set over the sort of December, January, February months. We should get some cleaner reads going forward, but there's no doubt it is definitely firmer. And that's probably consistent with the Reserve Bank suggesting that, rates are at 4.35 are appropriate, but they still have a very mild, weak tightening bias.
That's RBC Capital Markets Chief Economist Sue Linong. David, this is a curly one, but is there a possibility that the unemployment rate went down because fewer Australians were out there looking for work?
Thanks for the curly question there, Rachel. Look, there is no doubt that as more people opt out of the workforce, so they get despondent, they think unemployment's going to rise, that yes, that can artificially push the unemployment rate down. But on this occasion, it looks like the labour force is strong. It looks like when people go out, they expect to get work, and that's what's happening. The participation rate in this case has not changed much at all. But it's fascinating data in the sense that the Reserve Bank has raised interest rates 13 times since it began tightening monetary policy. And there's always been this question about when will the employment market break? When will we start to see this big surge in the unemployment rate? Rachel, at this point, that tipping point has not happened.
David Taylor, thank you. 3 million properties around the country are apartments or townhouses covered by a strata scheme. The majority of these schemes contract professional strata management companies to manage their buildings, which can charge thousands of dollars a year in fees for owners. Today, an ABC investigation has discovered the strata management industry is riddled with conflicts of interest and self-dealing, where subsidiary companies and opaque side deals with contractors generate millions of dollars in fees. So what can owners do to protect themselves? Alison Shaw reports.
Father of two, Adam Promnitz, bought an apartment in inner city Melbourne a decade ago.
I'd been on the strata committee for 18 months. We had this highly competent committee that was able to dig down into this. We effectively came across an entire culture of greed and incompetence.
His complex of 42 townhouses moved to self-management, which he says saved them about $10,000 a year. That was through halving their maintenance fees, removing their strata fees, and saving on commission payments for their insurance.
People just don't know that the industry is getting rorted to the effect of tens of millions of dollars a year. We discovered that there was never-ending conflicts of interest. There was a revolving stream of managers, but most importantly, they didn't disclose the financial benefits that they were getting from other services.
The experience led to him founding the Strata Owners Alliance, which educates owners on some of the industry's practices. Today's ABC investigation into high-profile strata management company NetStrata found they were charging excessive fees and taking kickbacks. Mr. Promnitz says the report didn't come as a shock.
It's a particularly poor case, but it's far from an isolated case. I think when people go and start looking at their own stratas, there's going to be a number of these cases uncovered.
He says it's imperative that owners take action and look at the fine print.
So the first thing that we tell people is, if you're not on the committee, get on the committee. You can do more work from within and being helpful from within. But then with a strata manager, start asking them questions. Start asking to see the accounts.
Cathy Sherry is a strata expert and law professor at Macquarie University. She says the problems in the strata industry are growing as more people move into high-density apartments.
It has its roots in the fact that we have reconceived housing in the past 30 years as not simply being a roof over everyone's head, but rather a money-making vehicle for a whole range of people.
She says more education is needed so owners can make themselves less vulnerable to exploitation.
Many, many people who buy into strata, they start out really ignorant about what the responsibilities are for the building, and they often intentionally remain ignorant. That lack of interest in the running of the building has been both encouraged and exploited by a lot of businesses associated with strata.
Professor Sherry is calling for a wholesale legal review into the industry's practices.
We desperately need a proper legal review of the strata industry and strata legislation. The idea that any agent can take a kickback in any other area of business or law would just be outrageous. It would be illegal. But somehow in strata, the practice has thrived, so much so that the strata management industry managed to convince the government that it was okay that they did this as long as they disclosed those commissions that they were receiving.
She believes governments have a responsibility to ensure they have appropriate laws and support available as they encourage more people to live and buy in high-density complexes.
Above all else, what we actually need is a department of strata titles. We need a government department that has expertise and responsibility for the planning and construction of high-rise buildings and the legal forms that are being created and assisting the people who live in them.
Macquarie University Law Professor Cathy Sherry ending that report by Alison Shaw. And The World Today has contacted the Strata Community Association, that's the peak body representing strata managers, for comment. On ABC Radio across Australia and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Australia has signed a new strategic defence pact with the United Kingdom. The new Status of Forces Agreement makes it easier for military personnel to operate together in a foreign country. It comes as the British Foreign and Defence Secretaries visit Canberra, where discussions on the AUKUS partnership are high on the agenda. Anna Pikett reports.
Today's strengthening of military ties between Great Britain and Australia comes at a time of geopolitical uncertainty as Russia's invasion of Ukraine and war in the Middle East continues. This is the first time the UK has signed what's called a Status of Forces Agreement with a non-NATO country. The British Secretary of State for Defence, Grant Shapps, says it's a significant step closer for both partners.
We could not possibly be closer, despite it being almost impossible to be geographically further apart. Our view and world outlook is very, very similar. Our understanding of the world order, almost identical, and the need to act together never more pressing than it is today.
The bilateral agreement sets out the terms under which military personnel can operate in a foreign country. Dr. Alex Bristow is a senior analyst with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
Certainly with AUKUS and all the thickening of the sinews of the defence relationship in particular, there is a need to have more of a legal basis, a treaty basis, to actually accommodate the numbers of visiting UK forces that we have coming to Australia.
It's more complicated than you might think.
Do we need to pay tax on bringing in certain goods that we're going to need to consume while we're there? Do we need to clear customs arrangements to bring in goods? Because we're obviously bringing weapons and explosive goods. Do we need to declare what's on the planes and the ships and everything? What happens if someone breaks the law while they're here? Are they subject to local laws? Are they subject to the military justice of the country that they're coming from?
Defence Minister Richard Marles says he was surprised a treaty-level agreement wasn't already in place.
And it means that the agreement that we have signed today is very practical, but it is also very timely. And it does reflect a relationship which has become much more strategic, a relationship which has a much bigger national security dimension.
Hamish de Breton-Gordon is a former British Army officer and military analyst in London. He's welcomed the tightening relationship.
I think the UK in particular is seeing Australia as being a very close ally, and the potential for the war to extend outside Ukraine is massive. So the support of Australia and the closer military liaison between the UK and Australia, I think, is hugely significant.
The visiting British ministers, Lord David Cameron and Grant Shapps, will head to South Australia alongside Defence Minister Marles and Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong for the annual AUKMAN talks. Discussions are expected to focus on efforts to help Ukraine against Russia's invasion and the AUKUS partnership to deliver nuclear-powered submarines to Australia. British defence giant BAE Systems, which is currently constructing Australia's Hunter-class frigate, is widely anticipated to be announced as the main builder for the new SSN AUKUS submarines to be assembled in Adelaide. But there are a number of uncertainties and potential complications, including the possibility of a second Trump presidency. Admiral Michael Rogers headed the US National Security Agency and commanded the US Cyber Command under both President Barack Obama and Donald Trump. He doesn't think there's cause for concern.
Australia is a critical ally and friend to the United States. I believe that America will remain fundamentally committed to this relationship and will remain committed to AUKUS.
Further announcements are expected to follow the AUKMAN talks.
Anna Pikett. An investigation is underway in the UK after staff at a London hospital tried to access the health records of the Princess of Wales. It's the latest turn in the now weeks-long frenzy surrounding the princess. Juliet Reardon is the editor-at-large of the Australian Women's Weekly. We spoke earlier.
Of course, there would be an expectation of privacy of medical records for anyone who is a patient there, let alone the Princess of Wales. I think the idea that records would be looked at and then presumably details leaked or sold to the media is actually quite shocking for me to hear. I can't imagine that the mainstream media would ever buy those records. And of course, it's an incredibly awful breach of the Princess of Wales's privacy.
Might it turn up that a UK news organisation has been approaching staff at that hospital and offering sums of money for information?
Oh, look, you can never tell, can you? But I think those dark days are in the past, and a lot of the stuff that we have seen around the Princess of Wales at the moment is conspiracy theories that are swirling on social media and online media that are not connected with the mainstream media. Now, of course, there is a problem here that in talking about them, even here, us talking about them, mainstream media is lifting those wild, wild conspiracy theories into a mainstream space. And that is giving them the sort of oxygen that they really shouldn't be given.
Isn't it a problem, though, of media strategy more generally? Is the royal family still employing old methods in that modern media landscape that demands a bit of new thinking?
I think certainly behind closed doors in Kensington Palace especially, they will be having some very, very fevered conversations about what they do from here on in. You know, they definitely thought that they were on the front foot, telling us that the Princess of Wales was having abdominal surgery and that she would be out of the public eye until after Easter. But that created this vacuum, this void of information about the princess, of pictures of the princess, someone who is in the media pretty much every other day. And that's left an area where people would suddenly come up with all of these theories and create stories where there were none. And maybe that was a bit naive of Kensington Palace, and they've been sticking to their guns largely. But then, of course, they produced that picture on Mother's Day, which then started even more problems when the photo agencies killed the picture, saying that it had been digitally manipulated in a way that broke their editorial standards. Now, you know, there were mixed messages there from the palace, because they were saying that we had to respect the princess's privacy and that she would be out of the public eye for a number of months. And then all of a sudden they release an image which has been manipulated. So they have sort of created part of the storm that they're a part of, I agree.
How do they fix it?
I think they are going to have to look at their media strategy. You know, Kensington Palace has tried to control the media in a much more stringent way than previous decades. They take their own pictures, they release their own pictures, they have their own media team on engagements who put out stories on the Kensington Palace website almost immediately. But they have to accept that if they do that, they can't expect the media to just be spoon-fed what they're given.
That's Juliette Reedon, editor-at-large of the Australian Women's Weekly. In the Northern Territory, residents of the town of Borroloola are bracing for a 1-in-100-year flood. The Defence Force raced against the clock last night to evacuate the town's most vulnerable residents before dark. But questions are being asked about why the evacuation window was so small. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
There was relief earlier this week when ex-tropical cyclone Megan weakened while crossing the coast near the remote top-end community of Borroloola. But since then, the rain's been non-stop. Calls to landlines and mobile phone numbers in the community weren't getting through this morning. Down the highway, working at the closest roadhouse, the Heartbreak Hotel, is backpacker Stella.
It's been wild. It has been raining for the last week, so trees have been falling down, branches are on the roads, rivers are, like, flooded, so we can't leave. We're just stuck here.
She's with dozens of tourists and residents from the King Ash Bay fishing camp on the swollen MacArthur River.
Yeah, last truck came last Wednesday, but we're already, like, running out of stuff because all of a sudden there's so many people here. Like, well, we were prepared, like we knew that the cyclone was coming, but we didn't realize that everybody from like King Ash Bay would be evacuating to here.
Now the river is expected to reach record-breaking flood levels.
The MacArthur River catchment is in major flooding at the moment. It was expected to peak about the MacArthur River mine last night, and downstream at Borroloola, we're expecting the peak to be later this afternoon, somewhere between 17.2 and 18 metres.
That's Sarah Scully from the Bureau of Meteorology. She says flooding could be 3 metres above the last record flood peak more than 2 decades ago.
It's record-breaking flooding, major dangerous flooding. The previous flooding, that high was 15 metres back in 2001.
Initial evacuation plans were suspended on Monday after bad weather prevented 2 ADF planes from landing safely. The move was criticised by Borroloola residents. Fire and Emergency Services CEO Michael Murphy says the Bureau of Meteorology was dealing with connection issues with some of its meters, and flood levels were worse than expected.
They had some intermittent connection issues with some of their meters. They reached out to the MacArthur River mine and they provided some more information which indicated the volume of water was much more significant than we originally thought.
That meant the Australian Defence Force had to race to evacuate residents before nightfall. Paul Avery is the Roper Gulf Regional Council Services Manager.
There were people taken from what's called Garawa Camp on the other side of the river from Borroloola. And then there are also people who left Borroloola by aircraft. The Defence Force came with aircraft and took people out and flew them to Darwin.
The BOM's Sarah Scully says while the intensity of rainfall is expected to wane over the coming days, wet weather is expected to continue.
With regards to the tropical low or ex-tropical cyclone Megan, where we do have a severe weather warning out for the Tanami, the Simpson and the Barkly districts, and that's with the heavy rainfall and the damaging wind gusts that are expected to continue well into tomorrow as well.
Sarah Scully from the Bureau of Meteorology, ending that report by Elizabeth Cramsey. Farmers producing caged eggs in Victoria are threatening to take the government to court over a planned phase-out of their industry. The state government has committed to ending the practice by 2036, but the industry says it needs more support to transition into other farming practices. Animal welfare advocates say the writing's been on the wall for some time. Angus Randall reports.
In 12 years' time, you won't see a cage-laid egg anywhere in Australia, if all goes to plan. State and territory governments have pledged to end the practice by 2036, but not everyone is happy. Victorian cage egg producer Brian Armad plans to take the state government to court to stop his industry being shut down.
This is our livelihood. It's what we've worked all our lives for. And you can't just decide that we're no longer allowed to continue to work and make a living to support our families.
Despite the commitment, in Victoria, the new standards have not yet been written. Brian Armad is teaming up with around 15 other Victorian farmers for a class action. Between them, they have around 1.5 million hens.
People have the right to choose what they want to buy and what they want to eat, and the market should determine how we produce eggs, not governments.
The market share of cage eggs has fallen from 70% in 2009 to 30% last year. Coles, Aldi and Woolworths all say they'll stop stocking cage eggs by next year. Egg consumption overall is on the rise, and there are other options for cage egg sellers outside of the supermarkets. Meg Parkinson is the president of the Victorian Farmers Federation Egg Group.
It's a sign that the market is moving, but it's not a sign that the market is leaving. The general market in the corner shops, takeaways, all those sorts of shops, often they want to buy the best site. The takeaways want to buy the cheapest eggs.
There are essentially three types of eggs for sale in Australia. Cage eggs, where chickens live in a cage inside a large shed, cage-free or barn-laid, where hens are free to move around the shed, and free-range, where birds spend some of the day outside and return to the barn to sleep. Meg Parkinson says the cost to renovate a cage barn to meet cage-free or free-range standards is significant.
You're going to have to go to the bank for money, and it's very hard to convince a bank you can make enough money to be able to do this when you've still got the same amount of birds you'll be selling the same amount of eggs.
According to animal welfare advocates, more than 5 million hens are confined to cages in Australia. Dr. Jed Goodfellow is the policy director for the Australian Alliance for Animals. He says the industry needs to move on.
Yeah, look, I find it quite astonishing, to be honest. The writing has been on the wall for battery cages for literally for decades now, and they've been given another decade or more than a decade to make this last change and transition. And even that's not good enough for them. So it sounds to me like this is nothing more than an empty threat.
He says the phase out of cage eggs can't be left to the market because most cage eggs are hidden from consumers.
The problem with leaving it to the market is the fact that a lot of cage eggs go into processed foods where the consumer doesn't have the ability to make the distinction. So that's why we need the regulation to ensure that this is a certainty and that the Australian egg industry can finally move on from this cruel practice.
Dr. Jed Goodfellow from the Australian Alliance for Animals, ending that report by Angus Randall. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When Kevin Rudd declared Donald Trump the most destructive US president in history, a lot of people agreed. But his scathing assessments of the former president don't sit so well now he's working as Australia's ambassador in Washington. So what happens to Kevin Rudd and our alliance with America if Trump returns to the presidency? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.